All right, thank you for your practice this evening. It's nice to be in the room. So the title of the talk is Nibbana for Everyone. And before I dive into that, I want to just reference where this idea comes from. Some of you are familiar maybe with a Thai forest monk named Ajahn Buddhadasa, who's a very important Thai forest monk of recent time. He died, I think, in the 90s. He has a monastery, some of you might have heard of, named Swan Mok, which is in southern Thailand. And he published a pamphlet, you can get it online, it's a PDF download free, called Nibbana for Everyone. And Ajahn Buddhadasa was a very revolutionary, very interested in trying to return the Dharma back to its original context and trying to get away from the city monks and the dogma and kind of where Buddhism kind of was becoming much more of a belief system, and he wanted to get back to practice, which is what he did, and he started this monastery called Swan Mok. And to emphasize the importance of this idea, I'll stand behind his words, not mine, because I think he's very trustworthy. And he says this: when many of you hear the words Nibbana for Everyone, you will shake your head and probably won't have any interest in the subject. Nibbana has become a secret nobody cares about. We have turned it into something barren, secret, buried away in the scriptures to be paid occasional lip service, even though nobody knows what it means. Without the theme of Nibbana, the Buddha's Dharma would be dead. Nobody interested in Nibbana, nobody interested in the Dharma. I feel it is time for us to get interested. Pretty strong words from a Thai forest master. And so I think what has happened over time is that one thing that the Buddha did very well, I think, in the early discourse is he takes things and he just turns everything upside down. He puts things right on their head. He kind of really does that with a lot of his terminology and a lot of his thinking. And I think because many of us grew up in America, probably most of you, in a kind of Judeo-Christian or kind of that kind of thinking, is that enlightenment sort of becomes the Buddhist alternative to something like heaven. I think for a lot of us, we get in that kind of thinking that like, oh, I'm going to do this thing and then I'm going to get this sort of cash and prize maybe somewhere down the road. And what the Buddha said, as soon as you make that posture, as soon as Nibbana becomes something in the distant, you're guaranteed to not get it, which I know is very frustrating, which is why we practice just present time awareness and we try to come into our direct experience, into our direct experience, into our direct experience, which we know is very difficult to do, to try to uncover and unlock and access this kind of innate quality of experience that is already there. In later schools of Buddhism, this is Nibbana turned into something like we know this term Buddha nature. It's just another play on Nibbana. Enlightenment, just another play on Nibbana. Everything kind of comes back to this. Secular mindfulness talks about non-reactivity or becoming responsive rather than reactive. Nibbana. There's a lot of terms that are really in that ballpark of Nibbana. Mindfulness is one of them. Equanimity is one of them. All of the Brahmaviharas are part of that. Anything that cools down our physical behavior, our verbal behavior, our emotional reactivity, our psychological experience, anything that cools down is Nibbanic, has a Nibbanic property to it. So there's lots of different entry points. There's lots of different doors we can go to get into this experience. And I think it's actually very, very ordinary. It's so ordinary that you don't see it. As the Zen folks like to say, what water, said the fish? Nibbana is the water that you're swimming in, looking for the water that you're swimming in, which I know is frustrating. So whether you've been sitting for 20 or 30 years or for 40 years or for tonight, Nibbana doesn't gain momentum over time. We just have the ability to access it more often. And so he says here, any reactive emotion that arises ceases when its causes and conditions are finished. So when you're done thinking about what you're going to do next week, Nibbana will return. So however long you want to do that for, worried about the future, worried about the state of the world, worried about this, worried about that, all of that, whenever you're done playing that game, Nibbana will be patiently waiting for your arrival. Which I know, again, frustrating. When these reactive patterns, when the causes and conditions are finished, Nibbana returns. Without it ceasing, without the ceasing of this reactivity, no life could endure it. That we are only able to survive because Nibbana nurtures us. What Buddhadasa is saying is that if you are in reactivity and tanha and craving all the time, you would literally go mad. You would not be able to stand it. No life would be able to endure that kind of psychological torment. Right? And so we are only able to survive because Nibbana nurtures us until it becomes a natural habit of mind. That we naturally return. We naturally return. And we do that. Every time you take your attention out of the thinking mind and back into the breathing body, you're inclining the mind towards a Nibbanic experience. So don't undervalue that. And think about the psychological reactive habit patterns you have to overcome. Endless. Endless. Right? And so there's the experience of being in your experience, right? You're taking a walk in nature. You know that, right? You're kind of tuned in. You're here. You're walking. You're doing it all the time. But then you go, oh, I forgot. I need to, and I pick up my phone or do whatever. I'm gone. See ya. And however long that goes on for. And that's not bad or wrong, or that's not a problem per se. But how much of it is? It's so useless. How much of your thinking life is actually helpful? I don't even want to throw a percentage out there. I'm not going to. You know? And so we really have to understand that this is, you know, this is a practice. Nibbana is a practice. So we do it until that becomes natural. There's a great teacher I referenced yesterday called, I always get the Ajahn's and the Sayadaw's wrong. Sayadaw Tejani, who's a Burmese monk, who has a book called When Awareness Becomes Natural. And it's all about this, whole book. I highly recommend it. And we're trying to return to this natural thing. And the thing I like about it, too, there's a lot of people, I very interested in this secularization of Dharma. Gil Fronsdale and Andrew Olinsky, there's another people who are using the same terminology, calling it natural, naturalistic of Dharma. And what the Buddhadasa is saying, and I believe what the Buddha is saying, is that Nibbana is not like this Buddhist thing that the Buddhists get if they do the Dharma thing right. It's actually here. It's just a natural part of the world. It's something that's just around. And people who don't even know about the Dharma, who have never meditated in a moment in life, experience Nibbanic moments all of the time. Right? You know, whether you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or an atheist or whatever, Nibbana, even animals have that cooling down experience. The Buddha just was able to recognize that there was something there that we really, that's where our well-being is, that's where our awakening is, that's where your life is actually happening one moment at a time, which I know you know. But it's really hard to live as though that were the case. Isn't it? I mean, it's like unbelievable. And so we have to understand that this is not a highfalutin, esoteric. I think Buddhism has elevated it to this status that almost, for many of us, just feels like impossible. I know that's how it felt for me for decades, until actually quite recently. And, you know, the farther away you put the Dharma goal, it's like, you know, the more difficult it is, because you're putting energy into this posture that actually guarantees you not to get the thing you're looking for. And so I think we have to rethink this idea. Now, where this sits in the kind of structure, I think in the probably the most basic structure of the Dharma, is what's called the Four Noble Truths, which I'm sure you've all heard about, which I think is another problematic teaching. But where it sits is that the Four Noble Truths are not the sort of dogma or the belief system of the Buddhists believe in the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are actually a present time psychological practice. The Four Noble Truths are a meditation practice as a task, recognizing the difficulty, recognizing the reacting of the difficulty, the reactivity, cooling down the reactivity, the ceasing, the coolness that arises. This is happening literally every single moment. Right? And so when we can get a sense of that ceasing of that reactivity, and that, so it's that third noble truth in the ceasing of reactivity, of a reactive motion, of a reaction, of a kind of burning quality, we have this nibbanic moment. And the Buddha's going, ah, witness that. Be mindful of that. See that. Taste that. Check that out. Hang out there. What's that like? Oh, I like that. That's nice. And then we do that. You have it, and then you go. You know that feeling in meditation where you're like, I'm totally meditating right now. And then it's gone because you're like, I'm going to get on my phone and get on spiritrock.com and border, get a retreat, get the book, get the thing, have the thing, get the thing. Going to get some cushions, some new cushions. Gone. Right? So frustrating, I know. But again, that's kind of, you know, we're trying to watch it. So there's a ceasing. So all this kind of, in the discourse is that the Pali term is nirodha, which means to cease. And when that reactivity ceases, what arises out of that is nibbana. So it's ceasing nibbana, and then right view, and then boom, 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 the Eightfold Path just opens right up. And the Buddha's going, go that way. Go that way. That's the way you want to go. And so we want to incline our mind and our lives to kind of be in that. It's really kind of just a sensibility, I think, a nibbanic sensibility. Funnily enough, the term, the Buddha just borrowed the term from ancient India. Ancient Indian cooking term turns out nibbana, which means to remove the pan from the flame. I love the Buddha. He's just like, yeah, like it's just like when it's not hot anymore and it cools down. That's what I'm talking about. We turn it into this big esoteric, mysterious thing. He's like, no, dude, I'm talking about not being on the fire anymore, right? So there's a movement we remove, and so like greed, hatred, and fear, or greed, hatred, and delusion, as it's usually called, are sometimes called in later schools of Buddhism the three poisons. But in the early discourses, they're actually the three fires. So what burns, what keeps the reactivity burning is the wanting and the not wanting and the fear of the wanting and the not getting and all of that business. I want this and I don't want that. I'm afraid I'm not going to get this. I'm afraid I'm going to get that. I think it's really greed, hatred, and fear. It's what I want. It's what I don't want. And it's what I'm scared of. Big topics, right? Big topics. But we have to kind of bring that movement back to that kind of coolness. And I think that that's not anything, I don't think there's anything special about that. I think that's just something that you can actually do in your first, you know, meditation class. And I think a lot of people get this too. I mean, think about it. Some of you have been at this for a long time, but even if you are new, do you remember the time when you kind of were in the Dharma group or you're at the mindfulness class and you had that like, oh, this is pretty good. I don't know what this is. It's that you get that, right? And we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't keep coming back if we didn't get that. You know, and the thing about it that I really love is that, have you noticed how familiar that feels? That doesn't feel like Star Wars Dharma, like in a galaxy long time ago, far, far away, there were these people in Nibbana and I'm not one of those people. Right? It gets so that way. Right? But it's like, no, and you get that. And so what that actually is a nibbanic experience. A cooling down of a reactivity. It's like, oh, it's so much better here than there, wherever there is, if there's even a there. But that's, you know, and we live in a world that's so, oh man, especially now, so hard. Our jobs have gotten so much harder, you know? I mean, if you were a Thai forest monk in the jungle, Thailand, in the 50s or the early 1900s, wasn't a lot to do. Might as well sit around and feel the breath, you know? They had it, you know, and I think the farther back you went, I think it got easier and easier and easier. But we don't have that. We don't have a reference point. Right? So we have to kind of uncover, discover, recover these kinds of ideas for ourselves. And to try to make sure that we get a sense of what we're trying to do is to try to develop a lifestyle as best we can that is going to support us in this cool mindedness. And then when you look at the elaborate structure of the Eightfold Path, how much reactivity do you experience as a result of just having a voice in a mouth that talks and says words? Or having ears that hear words and concepts? A lot of my reactivity, or a lot of things that pulls me into reactivity, is communicating with my fellow folks, my people of the world. Right? So I have to maybe be a little bit more careful about that. Now, extend that to phones and social media and emails. Oh my God. Right? How much reactivity do we experience in that space of verbal communication? I can just hear somebody say a sentence and get reactive. I was at the, by the way, good job on the Durango Hot Springs. Man! I went there last night and I was like, you know, trying to do the Dharma soak, and it's like, then you eavesdrop, you hear some of the things other people say, and you're like, oh my God. They did not just say that. Do they really think that? Right? And it's just like, boom, gone. What happened? Sound arose. Sound arises, and boom, I'm just like grabbing onto all of it. And looking around going, there's got to be an empty tub around here somewhere. It's Easter. It's 9 o'clock. What the hell are all these people doing here? Right? And it's just like, and I'm like, okay, I need to cool down. It's so easy to blame external stimulation on my internal reactivity, which is not helpful ever. I've decided that I'm having a difficult experience because you are saying words I don't like. Put that flag in the ground and stand by it. I've decided this moment should not be like this. Right? And how long does that go on for? Until somebody else says something. It's like, you know. And so, again, we have to have some humility, and we have to understand that the system is a little bit rigged against us. Right? So that's just speaking out. Now add action and work and livelihood and all the things that we do. And it's really, really hard. So I think one of the things that happens in the early discourses, and I talked about this a lot yesterday, is how much accountability and how much responsibility do we want to actually take for the experience that we're having and how we're relating to the experience that we're having. And I push back on the Dharma a little bit and go, okay, so like, am I really responsible for all of it? That seems a little unfair. It's like, well, I don't know. Like, you get to decide. Right? And so in the early discourses, it seems that he uses this word skillful, which I think is a good word. We want to be skillful. And what skillful means is we want to be invested in what actually works to liberate the mind. What actually works. Without the added feeling of, well, why do I have to always take the high road? And how come this? And how come that? And look at this guy over here. I mean, he won't get off his phone. No wonder why. It's just like, and so we start arguing with reality. You know, like it's a court of law, like we're pleading our case to the universe of how things should be different. And you're the only one in the courtroom just yelling it out. You know, when you sit down to negotiate with reality, reality never takes a seat at the other side of the table, does it? Like, I'm sorry, Dave, what was that? Oh, you don't like that. Sorry about that. We'll take care of it right away. And so a lot of it is just kind of entitlement. You know, like I feel entitled. I worked all day and I did this great Dharma event and I paid my $39 and I got to sit in this wonderful hot tub and listen to this guy talk about the state of the mortgage world. You know, it's like, yeah, that's what you get to do right now. Right? It's so hard. And so this is why these moments are so crucial, and I think we need to learn to recognize them. We need to be able to familiarize ourselves with them. We need to be able to see the value in that. We need to be able to see choices and decisions and things that we can do that contribute to that experience, which probably for most of us means there's probably some hard choices that maybe need to be made. You know, I notice this now so much, now that I go to restaurants again, that I noticed this recently. I forget where I was. I was with my friend Cheryl Sleen in California, and we were having lunch, and she went up to go to the bathroom. And how many seconds passed from the moment she got up her chair to leave till I picked up my phone? 3? It's like, really? You can't just sit in a restaurant for 7 minutes and look out the window? No, but maybe I can accomplish something. Maybe there's an email I need to read or a text I need. I'm going to be productive while Cheryl's in the bathroom for these 7 minutes and really get my life together. And I just watch that habit. It's like, wow, I didn't even do it. You know, so I think a lot of times we have to see that we have these volitional choices and these non-volitional choices. And a lot of these non-volitional choices are also non-volitional intentions, are also non-volitional thinking, that there's so much habituation in the mind. The mind has so much inertia in its habituation that these programs, these psychological programs, are off the grid. They're like running on solar power. They don't even need you anymore. They're like, yeah, we got our own power source. Right? Don't they? I'm like, I didn't even like do that. You know, and it's like, and so a lot of that is we have to come to terms with that kind of habituation. And this is why I think one of the things that makes all of this project so crucial and has such a much more pleasant journey is if we can really cultivate some metta or some kindness and some friendliness. And really, I think a big part of metta is having a good old-fashioned sense of humor. You know, can you really just laugh sometimes at some of the things your mind does and just feel like, oh. The nonsense, utter nonsense, without taking it personally, without judging ourselves for it. There was a joke that I forget who was one teacher I used to sit with. Said, imagine if in the meditation hall, they had like a little hat that you could wear, and during the meditation, everybody could listen to what was going on in your mind if you had the hat on. Who do you think would volunteer to wear the hat? Nobody. Right? And imagine if we all had the hat on, how loud it would be in here. And just the nonsense. Yeah. And so it's interesting when we look at like consciousness from a sensory experience. You know, I hear a sound, I don't necessarily take it personal, I see a sight. But thoughts, I'm so, feel like they're mine, and I'm so responsible, or they're so personal. Right? It's so hard to just see mental proliferation as kind of a sensory phenomenon, which is, from Buddhist psychology, all it is. And so what makes that, I think, so, what can make that nibbonic is trying to transform your internal dialogue. And I think that this is a very big function of what's traditionally known as right speech, which I think is a very underexplored teaching. You know, usually we talk about right speech, which just sounds like now we have to be polite in a Buddhist kind of way. Here's the Buddhist rules for talking. And it's kind of more about being nice. And there's 5 of them, and 5 gates sometimes they're called. And they're great, they're helpful. But I think they're just not enough. And so I think that when we really start to practice and we see that we have this internal chatterbox, that really one of the things that can be so helpful is to try to cool that down. Having a more friendly attitude towards the things that arise in our mind and really trying to develop another kind of voice. And I like this word voice, and I like this because the Pali term for right speech is samavacha. Vacha literally means voice. Right. And I like this idea of voice. I'm also a musician and a songwriter. And anybody here who's a writer, if you've ever taken a writing class, one of the first things they want you to do is to find your voice as a writer. Right. Find your voice. And I think we need to find our voices as people. Right. You know, and I said, that's a huge, huge project. And I think if we don't see that as part of a Dharma practice and part of a way to inspire and to live more into Nibbana, I think we're missing out, because I don't know about you, I talk all the time. I'm tired of talking. I'm talking right now about talking. It's like everywhere. Go to the Dharma talk to learn how to talk better. Like, oh yeah, I'm talking to myself right now. Like, that's going on all of the time. And to think that we do have some agency over that, just something that can be done about that. And I think that the spirit of that sila or that kindness is really trying to speak to ourselves more gently, more kindly, more cooling, a kind of, some of my internal dialogue feels hot and fast and tense and urgent and immediate and mean, and how come and do it now, and kind of right? And so that's really kind of when we think, thinking is really just you talking to yourself in your head, isn't it? I only know the English language. It's the only language I know. All my thoughts actually are in English. I learned that. It's very much conditioned. It's a very conditioned phenomenon, thinking and language. Always hard to figure out where to end with these things. So Nibbana is for everyone, regardless of anything. And so part of the learning process is for you to have to learn, how do you encourage and how do you inspire and how do you move through the world and through your life in a way that kind of keeps that in the background of like, okay. You don't cultivate it. It's already there. We just only cultivate qualities that allow us access to that. It's sometimes called Dharma doors. And it's understood that Dharma doors are endless. So you go through the door of metta, you go through the door of mindfulness, you go through the door of sila, you go through the door of harmlessness, you go through the... From what I've been told, I don't know if it's true, but they talk about 80,000 Dharma doors. Pick a door, you know, and get back in. And so I think it's my encouragement and my kind of... And I was very touched by this Nibbana for Everyone reading from Ajahn Buddhadasa. And I was very surprised it was a monk, and it's worded in such... Come on, everybody. We got to get back to this idea. This non-reactivity, this kind of... Almost birthright, feels like it would be the word to say. And again, it's the hard part is it's like... Here, you know, it you lean back into it, you don't reach out into it, right? And so the mind gets, you know, as soon as we start, the concepts get going. Nibbana is not a concept that you need to understand. It's an experience that you need to have and recognize. It's experiential. It's the experiential aspect of the Dharma. And lastly, I'll say this, just to give an analogy, Ajahn Sumedho talks about this. It's like maple syrup. Like, I'm from New England, and I love New England maple syrup. It's so delicious. And you could ask me, well, what does New England maple syrup taste like? I'm like, well, it's sweet. And you say, well, is it sweet like honey? I'm like, well, it's kind of like honey, but not really. And you say, well, is it like molasses? Yeah, it is a little bit, but not really. And we could go on and on for an hour, and you still wouldn't know what maple syrup tasted like. So the best thing for me would be to get a big spoonful of it and stick it in your mouth, and then you would know what it tastes like. That's Nibbana. You need to know what it tastes like. Right. And so you want to learn how to kind of get into that experience, right? And that's something that you can cultivate, you can kind of train and incur. And everything we do in Dharma practice, we have to remember, is training us to that, the returning to that. Right? Trying to make something happen, trying to subtract everything that's in the way. So thank you for your kind attention. I appreciate it. We are just about out of time now.